Lecture 26, Mummification, How We Know What We Know.
Welcome back. I'm glad you're here again. You've been absorbing an awful lot of Egyptian history. Let's take a break. Let's just take a deep breath and review what we've absorbed so far. We started with prehistory. Right, 700,000 years of prehistoric times. We saw Egypt united under Narmer. We talked about the mythology of this period. We then went on to the Pyramid Age, the Old Kingdom, where we traced the development of pyramids from the Step Pyramid right up to the Great Pyramid of Egypt. We saw Egypt decline, the first intermediate period. We saw it resurrect with the Middle Kingdom, the great pharaohs pulling it all together. Then we saw it decline again with the Hyksos, right? Two declines. And then we saw it rise to greatness with the 18th dynasty, right? And we traced the 18th dynasty with its great kings, Hatshepsut, Thutmose III, and we talked about Tutankhamun Akhenaten, right down to the end of the 18th dynasty. It's a lot of history. It's a lot, and I'm glad you're absorbing it still here with me. What I want to do today is take a little bit of a detour from the chronological approach, side trip, and I want to talk about something that's very Egyptian, very ancient Egyptian, mummies, right? Which is my specialty. There is something about mummies that is very special. Ask any museum curator. What draws people into museums is the mummy. People want to see a mummy. I've often thought about what's special about it. I think part of it is that when you're looking at a mummy, you're looking at a person, a recognizable person staring back at you over 3,000 years. There's something different. It's not just a statue. It's very different from an artifact. And I'll tell you something about that that has caused problems. As you know, the Egyptian Museum in Cairo is the storehouse of all great Egyptian treasures, and they have plenty of mummies. And for a long time, the mummies were in terrible condition. And the reason they were in terrible condition is that nobody thought of them as artifacts that had to be restored, had to be preserved. They were kind of like dead bodies. You don't touch them. So little was done for the mummies to keep them, to conserve them. And they really deteriorated considerably just because they were mummies. They were a separate category. But mummies are very special. And it's one of the things that people think of when you think of Egypt. You mentioned a few things. It's pyramids and it's mummies. And mummies is what people want to see. So there's something about mummies, no question about it. And so I'd like to take a little bit of a detour. In some detail, we're going to go into mummies. We'll do a few lectures on just everything about mummies. And by the end, I'd like you to be sort of little mummy experts. First of all, as I mentioned before, the ancient Egyptians never wrote down how to mummify a cadaver. They mummified people for 3,000 years, and there's not a single papyrus that tells us how to mummify a person. There are papyri that deal with medicine, as we've seen. There's certainly religious papyri. But there's nothing that tells us how to mummify a person. Why? Well, one is I think it's a trade secret. Embalmers were a kind of guild, almost like a union. And I think they wanted to keep it within the family. Often embalmers were families. It was a family profession. And it's the same today. Funeral homes are usually family professions. The son goes into the profession or the daughter goes in because the father was doing it. It's not the kind of thing, a kid goes to school and says, I think I'm going to be an embalmer if the family's not in it. So this is a similar thing. It was kept within families as kind of family secrets, trade secrets. Now, today I want to talk about, if they never wrote down how you mummify, what did they tell us about mummification? How do you figure out how to make a mummy? One source, it's not a great source, are the tomb walls. As you know, they painted almost every aspect of daily life on their tomb walls. So maybe you'll get a picture of somebody being mummified. Not quite. You get pictures of people working in the fields. You get people at banquets, drinking, getting drunk. You get fishing. They're hunting. Nobody's being mummified. The closest there are two tombs, Thebes, right, in Thebes, that show a mummy in the last stages. He's being wrapped. Right? And what's neat about it is it gives you a little detail that you wouldn't catch otherwise. I think it's kind of neat. The painting shows a mummy with two embalmers working on it, and they're just doing the last stages of bandaging. They've got little thin strips of bandage, and they're wrapping it around. But what's neat, the detail that I like, is the mummy isn't laying on a table. It's not on a table. It's on two blocks. It's on two blocks. And the reason is, anybody who's worked with bodies knows, you work on bodies, you put them on chalk, so to speak. You elevate them off the table, because if you have to get under it, when you're passing the bandage, you don't want to have to lift it off the table all the time, so you could just simply pass it beneath the mummy. So these guys are working on a mummy that's up on blocks, kind of, very much like if you jack up a car. So they didn't have to lift the body every time. So it's a nice detail, but that's all the tombs give us. That's about it in terms of the mummification process. Right? Now, we have some papyri that are relevant. They don't tell us mummification, but they're relevant. And that's what I want to tell you about today. I want to tell you about a few of them. One is called the Embalmer's Archive. They were found in the area that we call the Fayum. It's southwest of Cairo. And it's a bunch of papyri that are the records. It's an archive. The records of families of embalmers. And it's as you know, it's not going to tell us how they did it. But it tells us something about the life of an embalmer, the profession. First of all, they were called men of Anubis. That was sort of the name of the embalmers. Now, why Anubis? Anubis is the jackal-headed god. Right? He's shown as a man with a jackal's head. Now, the jackal was associated with the dead because jackals' digestive systems are such that they prefer rotting meat. So they used to prowl cemeteries looking for old bodies to eat because it's sort of pre-digested protein. So the jackal became the god of embalming, Anubis. And at mummifications, there would be a priest who wore a mask of a jackal, a big black jackal's mask, and he was sort of representing Anubis. So these embalmers in the Embalmer's Archive are called men of Anubis. There were also a couple of other titles. One guy was called the sealer. He was in charge of the tomb. The embalmers apparently also had broad responsibilities. They weren't just going to mummify it, here's your body, man, goodbye. No. They also, kind of like a side industry, I mean, and people do this in industry all the time. You start out with one specific thing, and then you think, how can we expand? Well, the embalmers eventually became the people who were responsible for tomb maintenance, to maintain the tomb. Now, what do I mean by tomb maintenance, you know? Isn't it you just shut the door, the guy's buried, and that's it, you walk away? Not at all. In Egypt, which is a civilization that went on, as you now know, a long time, there were problems, questions of ownership of tombs. For example, I mean, imagine this. Your grandfather is buried in a tomb, and your father oversees the tomb, they visit it, and maybe you visit it. But what about 500 years down the road? Is anybody going to visit that tomb? Maybe your family dies out. And then the question becomes, whose tomb is it? Perhaps at some point it's robbed. The tomb is vacant. Now whose tomb is it? It belonged to your family. Nobody's around to claim it. There were many, many cases in the courts, the law courts in ancient Egypt, about tomb ownership. Somebody said, no, my family owned that tomb. And said, no, it's a vacant tomb. I took it. My family's had it for this. And they were arguing. So the job of these sealers, the guys who were charged of sealing a tomb and maintaining it, was to keep track of whose tomb was whom, kind of like cemetery caretakers. Hopefully the families would be around and watch over the tomb. So you were paid a fee for doing this. And you might be paid a fee to make sure that the inscriptions aren't falling off the wall, things like that. So embalmers did a variety of things. Now from this archive, we also have an oath of allegiance that the embalmers took. There were two families that really this archive is comprised of, two family records. And the deal was, the oath of allegiance is basically from one family to the other saying, I'm not going to encroach on your territory. So in other words, they carved out part of the town. Anybody dies in this area, that's yours. Our area is over here. So you had territories. that were sort of divided among these embalming families. But, as I say, the embalmer's archive, as we call it, doesn't tell us much about the process. And that's what we really want to know. How'd they do it, this secret? Well, there's a couple of other papyri that give a little more information. And one is called the Rhind Bilingual Papyri. Now, as you remember, papyri are named after the people who discover them or who own them. And Rhind was Alexander Rhind. He was a Scottish lawyer who went to Egypt in the 1860s, right? Fell in love with Egypt, and excavated. Now, in 1860, right at the beginning of Rhind sort of looking around, Rhind discovered a tomb. He was in the Thebes area. Right? He was actually not far from the Valley of the Kings. Not far. In a neighborhood called Gurna, which is honeycombed with tombs. Not tombs of the kings, kings of buried valley kings, but tombs of fairly well-to-do people. And he found a tomb that was sealed in plaster, that the door had been sealed, and it had a stamp on it, so it was sealed during the reign of Amenhotep III, New Kingdom, right? Our man Amenhotep III of the 18th dynasty. So he thought he had found an intact 18th dynasty tomb. He was disappointed when he opened the tomb. He broke down the seals, you know, opened the plaster, went in, and it had been a tomb that had been robbed, terribly robbed, and probably resealed during the time of Amenhotep III. What he found on the floor of the tomb were many mummies, damaged, terribly damaged. And also on the floor were 14 of what we call mummy tags. Now, mummy tags are little pieces of wood. They're like maybe twice the size of a dog tag that people would wear around their necks in the army, in the military, in the old days. And they're wood. And these had the names of the various mummies on them. They were placed on mummies in the embalmer's workshop. Now, think about an embalmer's workshop. It's like a funeral parlor. You got lots of people. You know, you're not the only person who's dead. You have several bodies you're working at the same time. And especially after they're wrapped, how do you know who's who? How do you keep track? Sometimes you might write on the bandages who it is. But always, almost always, embalmers put on the toe, on the foot, like you see in morgues, you know, in the movies, there's a little tag, a little dog tag type thing with the mummy's name and address, so to speak, this belongs to this family. So you'd have the information. Rhind found 14 of these tags on the floor. So this is a nice source of mummy tags, more than we ever found in one place. But the good news is, Rhind kept going. In the back of this tomb, he discovered an intact tomb that the robbers apparently had missed. Right? And it went down deep into the ground. It was a tomb of the Roman period, late, when the Romans were occupying Egypt. Right? But it was intact. He found a stone sarcophagus, a nice wooden canopy around it. The lid was removed. And inside, there's a gilded mummy. Now, by gilded, I mean the mummy had been sort of coated in gold, a little bit on the face especially. Gold was the metal of immortality. Now, the reason is that gold never tarnishes. You know, silver, as you know, you've got to polish it forever. But gold doesn't tarnish. So, because gold doesn't change, the hope is that you'll associate the mummy with gold. The mummy will be unchanging, untarnished, undamaged for eternity. As a matter of fact, in tombs, the burial chamber was often called the gold room. So he's found this mummy, rather nice mummy, right? Gilded, a little bit of a kind of made of leaves, a kind of crown around the head. But more important for us, on the left side of the mummy was a papyrus. This is one of the Rhind bilingual papyri, what I told you we were going to talk about at the beginning. First of all, let me say this. The papyrus is it's a misnomer to call it bilingual. It's not two languages. But in the early days, they tended to do that. It's 1860, they just discovered it, they name it, it's bilingual. It has two scripts. It's the same text in Demotic, the period of the language, or the script of the late period, and also Hieratic, which is a cursive form of hieroglyphs. So it's really got, it's Egyptian. That's the only language, but it's Egyptian in two different scripts. But the important thing about this papyrus is it tells not how to mummify, but it tells the details of wrapping and some of the rituals. This is a key source for us. Key source. Now, what does it say? One of the things it says is that the mummy is left in the place of cleansing for 35 days.
Yeah.
Place of cleansing. It's interesting. We know that the mummy was at some time placed in a powder called natron to dehydrate it for about that, and it sounds like that's what it is. So we think that, how long was it placed in there? 35 days. So the mummy is dehydrating perhaps for 35 days. It also tells us a little about the magical rituals that took place. And numbers were important in embalming. For example, it talks about the seven openings of the head. Well, it's got to be the eyes, ears, nostrils, mouth. Seven was a sacred number. There were also seven sacred oils that were used in preparing the mummy. And it also talks about there are 17 rituals that have to be performed on the body. And it even says there are 17 parts of the body. Now you wonder, 17 parts of the body. I mean, if you had to sit down and figure out parts of the body, you'd never come up with 17. But it was a magical number. They wanted to come up with 17. What are the parts? Let's see if I remember them. They're the seven openings of the head. They say there are four internal organs. It's lots more than that. But there were four sons of Horus. Horus had four sons who protected the internal organs, and they usually talked about it as if there were just four internal organs. So we've got seven openings in the head. We've got four internal organs. We've got two arms, two legs, and we've got a front and a back. Right? That's hopefully adds up to about 17. So they said there were 17 members of the body. Right? And then it also said that the body had to be placed in the tomb after 70 days. So this papyrus is a good source of how long it took, what was going on, and we got these numbers. 7, 17, 70, right? 7's an important number. It also tells us that each bandage, as it's put on, has a name. There were magical names for the bandages because they were going to protect the arms, the hands, the fingers. So it was a big ritual. When you mummified, at least we know from this papyrus, it wasn't just take out the internal organs. It was a big ritual that had to be done in a certain way. Now, this rhined bilingual papyrus, this is just one of them so far, also had drawings. There were drawings on the top of it, little vignettes, right? And sometimes it showed the dead person lying on a funerary couch. Now, a funerary couch is a special kind of bed. It had legs like the feet of animals. And sometimes it would have at the head, where the headboard would be like a head of an animal. And it shows this deceased person lying on it, attended by the gods. Later, real ones would be found in Tutankhamun's tomb. Yeah? But this was part of the ritual. But this is only one of the papyri rind found in this tomb. The man's wife was also there. This was the burial of a man with his wife. Now, the man's wife died only 46 days after the husband. Didn't have much time to mourn. They both died in 9 BC. It was during the reign of Augustus. Right? And she had a papyrus also, buried with her mummy on the left side, almost a duplicate of the one for her husband. Right? It's a curious thing, by the way. You know, why bury them with a papyrus that tells you how to wrap a mummy? You wonder. I wonder why they had this. But she was buried with it also. And there's a very interesting little touch about her papyrus. You know, it says that she mourned her husband, but just for this 46 days. It's a little unclear. It could be 46, could be 48. But about that. It says she mourned for her husband. And the word that they talk about when they say she mourned, it's an Egyptian word. But at the end, there's a little ideogram, a picture or determinative telling you, helping you what it means. It's a lock of hair. That's the symbol for mourning. Now, why? Because when a person died, mourning was an important part of the ritual. Very much like, you know, when we go to the funeral and that kind of thing. But what they would do is the women of the house, and if it was an important person, the women of the village, would all tear their hair. They would pull out their hair as a sign of, oh, grief, how terrible it is. So hair became a sign of mourning. That's what the rape of the lock is about. You know, that's a sign of mourning, hair. So anyway, the rind bilingual papyri, these two papyri, one for a man, one for a woman, tell us something about how long the procedure took, what the wrapping was right, about the rituals, but we really don't get the gory stuff, the nuts and bolts of embalming. We don't get that. But there's another papyrus that was found, which is called the Ritual of Embalming. Right? It's different from this Rhine bilingual part. The Ritual of Embalming has a couple of really great details. First of all, it says, the bandaging took place 46 days after death. Now, that's interesting. That's a nice detail. If you combine everything we know, well, if it stayed in the natron or whatever for 35 days, and there was a period of mourning, about 3 or 4 days when the body wasn't handed over to the embalmers. So we're almost able to reconstruct what happens to a body when it dies. Person dies, and then you've got a period of mourning that the family can get its grief out, see the body, stays at home, couldn't stay at home much longer, especially if it's hot, starts to decay, you know, gets pretty smelly. But then it's brought to the embalmers on the West Bank, right? And then natron for 35 days, and then day 46, it's wrapped. Now, what happens for the rest of the days, right? Because we know it's supposed to be buried on the 70th day, right? So we've got a bunch of days. The answer is, this must be a time for rituals. This must be where the priests say the prayers, where all kinds of rituals go on, right? So this helps us. There's a couple of other really great details in this papyrus. One I love. I think it's just so almost sweet. It has vignettes, again, little pictures that go with the text, this papyrus. And one of them shows the god Horus, the falcon-headed god. He's standing behind the funerary couch on which the deceased is, and he's bringing the bandages that the deceased is going to be wrapped with. And the wonderful little detail is that if you look at the bandages that Horus holds in his hands, you'll see they have ragged edges. That wasn't just happened to be that way. No. There was a ritual, I'm virtually certain, in which the bandages were made from the bed linens of the person who died. They were torn. Now remember, the Egyptians didn't have scissors like we did. It's not easy to get an easy edge. Not easy. But I think there was a part of a ritual that you always were buried with something that you used in daily life. A little bit like, you know, a bride has something old, something borrowed, something new. This is something you went to the next world with something familiar. So the family would probably tear some of the bed linens, give them to the embalmers to use. So even when the god Horus is coming with mummy bandages, they're ragged. The only bandages I've ever seen, you know, I've looked at a lot of mummies. And, you know, the study of mummy bandages is a thing in itself. Textile people look at them. You can tell when the mummy, sometimes when the linen was woven, by how tight it is. You can tell whether the person was wealthy or poor by the quality of the linen. If you analyze what's in the linen, you can tell what resin was used to stick it. A lot can be done with just mummy bandages. And I've looked at a lot of mummy bandages. I've never seen mummy bandages that were finished on both ends. In other words, there's always at least one end that's ragged, torn. You would think that if you were really wealthy, there might be an industry in just somebody weaving mummy bandages so you could have new things for your mummy. I think it was a ritual. I think that you weren't supposed to have new mummy bandages. The only example I can tell you of a mummy bandage that's finished on both edges, which means it was woven just to be, and it looks like an ace bandage, you know, kind of like that Tutankhamun had in a little burial pit that was found near his tomb with the remains of his mummification equipment. There were bandages that were finished on both sides, which means that some weaver was hired to weave special bandages for the pharaoh. But that's the only example I've ever seen of finished on both sides. But this papyrus tells us a little bit about it. It's kind of neat. Now, we still haven't gotten the nuts and bolts. The ritual of embalming tells us one other thing that I think is important. It tells us what spices were used, what incenses were used for the mummy. Frankincense and myrrh. And it says, frankincense was placed in the head. Not sure exactly why. The brain was probably removed, usually. So maybe it's put in through the nostrils. Maybe it helps the smell. But frankincense was for the head, and myrrh was for the body. Often, after you've removed the internal organs, you can put spices inside, incense. So it wouldn't smell. It would help dehydrate, and it wouldn't smell. So this tells us also about the incenses. Right? So some details, but nothing surgical, nothing clinical yet. If you want to look for something clinical, the best place to go, the best place is our Greek tourist, Herodotus. Right? Remember, he went to Egypt in 450 BC, roughly, saw everything, and wrote it all down. Now, he was, of course, as anybody is who goes to Egypt, curious about mummies. Herodotus wanted to know. So he asked. Now, I am sure that Herodotus didn't see a mummification. You know, think about it. There are people like we are. If you were interested in how a person's embalmed, an embalmer isn't going to say, come on over, I'll do one, and you'll see it. It doesn't happen that way. But I think Herodotus was told a great deal. Now, remember, it's a trade secret. But not for Herodotus. He's a Greek. He's going back home. And he's going to write it down. So Herodotus, 450 B.C., writes down how they actually did it. And he is one of our best sources. He's not an Egyptian writing how they did it. He's not an embalmer, a man of Anubis writing how they did it. But at least he's telling us something about the surgical procedure. Now, he tells us a lot more, too. Really, really kind of good guy. He's willing to tell it all. He tells us, of course, about the mourning procedure. He says when a person dies, the women tear their hair, tear their clothes, and throw sand on their heads. This, by the way, is indeed what women did in ancient Egypt. They did do that. We know. We have scenes on tomb walls of that. Also, he says, right, when they brought the mummy to the embalmer shop, the embalmer would take out models of what you could get for your money. You know, here's the deluxe model. You know, they pull out a statue. Now, if you don't have that much money, we'll give you this one. And then we have the economy mummification. So there were three different price ranges depending upon what you could afford, right? Which is not unlike a funeral today. You know, the Egyptians were people just like us. But Herodotus does tell us how they did it, at least what he was told. Herodotus says that a man came and drew a red line on the abdomen. Right? Red line. Now, this man is, in a sense, an anatomist who was going to show the embalmers where to cut open the abdomen to remove the internal organs. And he says, then a man called the slitter, a surgeon, in a sense, came and with a sharp Ethiopian stone. Now, what is a sharp Ethiopian stone? He says, with a sharp Ethiopian stone, cut open the abdomen. He made the slit where the red line had been marked. A sharp Ethiopian stone is obsidian, volcanic glass. Right? You know, Ethiopia just means, if you think about what Ethiopia means, the name, burnt face. It's the land of people who had burnt faces, black faces. Right? So Ethiopian stone is a black stone, obsidian. So the man comes and cuts open, and then they remove the internal organs. Herodotus tells us that. He also says they remove the brain with an iron hook through the nose. Right? So that's apparently how they get rid of the brain. Now, iron was in use in Herodotus' time, 450 B.C. Right? And they probably went in through the nasal passage with a hook and pull out the brain a piece at a time. At least that's what Herodotus is telling us. And then he says, and then they place the body in natron, this material that's going to dehydrate the body. And I'm going to talk about natron later. But there's been a controversy because of the word Herodotus used for putting the body in natron. He uses a Greek word, which is the word that's used to preserve fish. So they're saying they preserve the mummy with the natron like fish. Now, natron is basically a salt. And how do you preserve fish? Well, one way is to salt it dry, but you could also pickle it. You could also put it in brine. So for many years, nobody was really sure. Did they put the mummies in a pickling solution for a while and then dry them out? Or did they put it in dry nature and salt it like fish and then take it out? Nobody was really sure. But Herodotus at least gives us basic details. Internal organs are removed. Brain is removed. Body is placed in natron for 70 days. And he says 70 days, right? We have an earlier Egyptian account that says 35 days. We're going to have to reconcile that, and we will. But the point I want to make today is that the Egyptians certainly don't give us the details that we want about mummification. If we really want to figure out the details, we're going to have to look at the mummies themselves. And that's what we'll do next time. See you then.